Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Alexander, the Chair of the Department of History, Politics and Justice, and a Professor of Political Science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent project is a book examining the Electoral College, which draws upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected with students over the past three elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Alexander.
Hello, Ian. Nice to be here.
And clearly, things are going to come to a crunch in Ohio. In fact, Mitt Romney's campaign apparently is going to even show up there tomorrow. And, of course, the last-minute campaigning is pretty intense. And the assumption is that if Romney doesn't win Ohio, he doesn't have a prayer at the presidency. And pretty much the same is true of Obama, although apparently he's not quite as in dire shape vis-a-vis Ohio. But what's going on with the Secretary of State there in Ohio, who's apparently brought in some last-minute rules about provisional voting? He's been pretty consistently hostile to making voting easy, it would seem.
Yeah, there's been a lot of controversy in the state over Secretary of State Houston. And, you know, on the one hand, you know, his office is saying, you know, we've tried to make things easier by mailing out so many absentee ballots on the front end. On the other hand, there's a lot of people that say that is a recipe for disaster. It could lead to a lot of provisional ballots being cast on Election Day. As you know, he had also looked to reduce the number of early voting days, which was, of course, rejected by the courts. And so it's been a real battle, I think, certainly on the ground from the grassroots, both Democrats and Republicans, to try and make sense of those rules. That provisional ballot issue, I think, really could play a pretty big issue in the state if indeed there are a lot of provisional ballots cast on Tuesday.
Well, apparently the stricture that he's insisting on is that the voter has to fill it out, and if there's any mistake, the entire thing is thrown out. Is that...
And, of course, this is supposed to or projected to hurt Democrats or Obama supporters more substantially than Romney supporters. And there's been some glitches in getting absentee ballots out to heavily populated Democratic areas, particularly northeastern Ohio. And, again, the question is, you know, these provisional ballots are likely not to break evenly, have an even distribution. They're likely to break more so for Democrats. If there is a razor-thin election, which a lot of the polls are taking a look at and saying it's going to be really, really tight, you know, you're looking at 20, 30,000 votes that could make the difference in the state this time around. If there are indeed a lot of provisional ballots cast, and those provisional ballots won't be counted until November 17th. And so if it does come down to Ohio, if it does come down to just this one state, boy, we could be in for a little bit of 2000 all over again.
Well, apparently, the Secretary of State, Husted, when the judge overturned his restriction of early voting, the judge, apparently then Husted openly defied the judge's order, ordering local election officials not to comply. And then the federal judge, Peter Economos, ordered Husted to personally attend a court hearing. And I believe Husted already fired two Montgomery County Board of Election members because they voted to allow early voting on weekends, which Husted opposed. So I guess, you know, we have a pretty broken electoral system in this country. We saw it in Florida in 2000. Are you suggesting that we're going to have another, instead of Florida being the sort of banana republic of voting, after 2000, is equal derision is going to be leveled at Ohio if it ends up being a mess and not even resolved until the 17th?
Well, there's a lot of talk that Florida could be the Florida of 2012 with some of the edicts that have been put forth there in that state on early voting. You know, I think that you mentioned the electoral rules and certainly the electoral system in the state being a bit broken. Just the focus on you know, whether it's absentee voting, whether it's early voting, whether it's questions about provisional ballots. And then the Electoral College, I think, is another major issue. I mean, there's a lot of people in places like California that are going, you know, what about us? Nobody's paying attention to us unless they want some money. And, it's, you know, it's like they're running for president of Ohio rather than president of the United States of America. So that just highlights one other issue in the American political process is, you know, that it's the Electoral College that really matters and certainly not the popular vote. And that's yet another issue that's trending right now is the notion that we may have indeed a situation where we have a popular vote winner, and a number of the projections are looking at Romney may win the popular vote but not win that electoral vote. So that just adds another layer to the onion there.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice and professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent project is a book examining the Electoral College. And as you just mentioned, the Electoral College may, well, it always decides, but in this case, we may have a repeat of Florida in the sense that Al Gore was 660,000 votes ahead in the popular vote, but lost in the Electoral College by a few votes. Obama could actually get a substantial Electoral College victory and be behind in the popular vote. There's an expectation because of the storm in New York and New Jersey, at least 500,000 popular votes will probably not be cast, which would normally go to the Democrats. On the other hand, here in California, there have just been record registration this year with an extra 1 million voters, a third of which are Democrat, a half of which are independents, and the rest Republicans. So that may balance out. What's your sense of course, we're getting in the prediction business, which is a little hairy, right?
Always shaky, right? You know, I think one of the things that's coming out is the, you know, I think a lot of Republicans are pointing to an enthusiasm gap that this time around here in 2012, that Republicans are pretty enthusiastic to get out there and vote this time, and particularly a lot of Southern Republicans. And, you know, they're looking to say that perhaps that, you know, Romney really carries the South in a big way. And then again, a lot of these battleground states like Ohio and Virginia and North Carolina, Colorado, that Obama, even if he, you know, he may be able to squeak all of those out, but he's going to get all of those electoral votes in those states, and with not a lot of gap in the popular vote in those states. And that's where we could see that major kind of distortion between the Electoral College vote, where Obama can really kind of pile it on, and the popular vote, where Romney may perform very well in a lot of Southern states and very closely in a lot of the battleground states.
So what's your sense in Ohio, where you are, Robert Alexander? I mean, the polls have consistently put Obama ahead, but now they're talking about them closing and narrowing. So, and of course, you know, there's a big gap between what Nate Silver and the New York Times is saying and what everybody else is saying. And Nate Silver has actually a pretty good track record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the campaigns have just been in Ohio over and over and over again. I'm sure that they're waving to each other down I-75 or I-70. I mean, they are everywhere. They're in the state on the same day. Both sides are saying that they've got excellent ground games. The Obama campaign has been in Ohio for 4 years now. They have more offices than the Romney campaign does in the state. But at the same time, the question is how sophisticated are they relative to the Romney supporters? You know, I think turnout obviously will be really, really important. You know, the polls have consistently shown Obama ahead, and that's got to give the Romney campaign some pause. You know, the appearance of third-party candidates on the ticket, you know, it could, at this point, it really could be any singular specific issue. And so I think it's very tight. I think that the odds, you know, in addition to Nate Silver, I think that the odds are Obama will likely carry the state, but that's certainly not a given, and should be really competitive tomorrow night.
Well, my understanding is if it's as competitive as a lot of the polls indicate, with a 1% difference between the two, already the polls are indicating, the same polls are indicating that the third-party candidates could affect the outcome, that the Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson, I think he's polling it at about, what, 4%? And the Green Party candidate's polling at about 2%. And Good, Virgil Good, is about at 0.5%. So what's your sense of whether we're going to have another Florida where, as you recall, the vote for Nader cut into what would have been a substantial victory for Gore, and Bush only won by 537 votes?
Yeah, I think that the third, as I said, it really could turn on third party candidates in this particular, in this state. Gary Johnson, you know, he is polling. I've seen polls where he's getting 3-4% of likely voters. I'll be surprised if he pulls 4%. I'd be really surprised at that. You know, 4 years ago, Bob Barr, who was running as a Libertarian, you know, he got less than 0.5% of the vote. So, I mean, it wasn't a lot. But, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 votes could make the difference, especially, you know, the assumption is that Johnson's going to be pulling from Romney supporters far more heavily, maybe 2 out of every 3 than the Obama support. Jill Stein, the Green Party member, does not seem to be catching too much fire in the state. But again, a few thousand votes could make the difference. In 2004, 119,000 votes total separated John Kerry from George W. Bush. And had Kerry been able to take the state, he would have won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote. So, I mean,
by 2.4 million, right?
Right. And so we almost had the exact same thing happen 2 elections in a row, right. Only this time it would have benefited the Democrat. We would have probably seen some huge, some real calls for real change in the Electoral College. Of course, it didn't happen. By 119,000 votes, that's it. And, you know, last time around, in 2008, there were probably 70,000 votes that didn't go to the two main parties. So, an election that may be as close as most of the analysts are saying, it really could turn on whether or not you really want to send a message to the two main parties.
Well, in the case of Gary Johnson at 4%, which is substantial, and he's a pretty good candidate from my understanding, former governor, and there was a lot of support for Ron Paul, even though he's running as a Republican, he's essentially a Libertarian. So that's a constituency that might show up, right? And if it does, it's going to hurt Romney.
Well, I'm actually in the north central part of the state, and it's a pretty rural area. And you do see Gary Johnson signs littering the rural countryside. You absolutely do. And you may recall, Mitt Romney did not have the easiest path to the nomination in the Republican Party. Massachusetts moderate. He certainly went to the right, and he's been, you know, peeling back toward the center here since the first debate. And, there's a lot of skepticism, I think, of some of those more libertarian-type Republicans, and I think that they really don't trust Mitt Romney. I think that was one of the things that Rick Santorum was really trying to impress upon Republican voters in the primary, certainly in the state of Ohio, was, you know, who can you trust on health care? Can you trust, you know, Romney care, or can you trust somebody like Rick Santorum, or perhaps a Ron Paul and so forth? So I think that there probably will be a relatively large number of people that at the end of the day will indeed vote for Gary Johnson, still have a healthy skepticism of Mitt Romney. Now, the question is, you know, are they more skeptical of Romney or have just more antipathy toward Obama? And that might actually tilt them toward voting for Romney.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent project is a book examining the Electoral College, which draws upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected with students over the past 3 elections. Now, the Electoral College is a relic, but and as you pointed out, it's, you know, here in California, you barely know there's an election going on, but for the propositions on the ballot, it is, I think, very peculiar, the idea that all of the money, and that's, we're talking about $6 billion, almost all of it gets spent in about 13 states, and the rest of the country basically is ignored. But, of course, if you change that, it may have the reverse effect, where all the money is going to be spent in California and New York and Texas. So I'm not sure what the answer is in terms of money, But the Electoral College itself feels a little kind of shaky in a way. I mean, didn't one of the electors switch last time?
Well, what you're referring to is the, you know, been called the faithless elector.
Right.
And actually, we've had two of the last three elections. In 2004, there was an elector in Minnesota that actually voted for John Edwards for president and for vice president. And then we had an elector in 2000 that abstained in Washington, D.C. So we've had faithless electors occur in the past. There's no constitutional requirement that an elector votes as anticipated. It does add that extra layer to the process. I mean, Americans are already pretty cynical about our politics. When you add this additional layer of having an elector translate the popular vote into the electoral vote, that adds even, I think, more cynicism to the process. Most of the time, 99% of the time, electors vote as anticipated. They're party loyalists. Many of them are party leaders. They are county chairs of Democrats or Republicans. They're loyalists. They've contributed money. But you can be a good party loyalist, but not necessarily someone who's loyal to the top of the ticket. And that's something that we've seen occur in past elections. And then even in this election, there's been some chatter that there's some Republican electors out there that are still miffed about the treatment that Ron Paul received during the convention.
So there you have it, another wild card, right? On top of all of the sort of dirty trickery and suppression and complicated rules and provisional ballots and the time that it may take to count them. And then on top of it, when they finally make the count, somebody's likely to jump ship. I mean, again, I guess I just scratching my head in amazement at this whole system. But, you know, after Florida, everybody thought they were going to change it, but they haven't.
Well, you know, interestingly, in our first survey of electors, and that's what we did, was we surveyed the actual electors themselves, and a lot of renewed attention after Florida in 2000. And so we thought, well, who are these people, right? And what we found out was that there were some vigilant, intense lobbying campaigns on electors to actually get them to change their votes prior to their casting their votes, because electors actually vote in December. So, you know, Americans go to the polls in November, but those we're actually voting for the electors, and those elector slates are determined, and they vote in December. Well, what we've found is that there's been these really, really strong lobbying campaigns of electors. And so for most of us, we think that the election's over in November, but it's really not. There are a number of people that continue the campaign, and they actually take it to members of the Electoral College. We found electors back in 2000 that had death threats placed against them, vigilant email campaigns. Likewise, we found electors in 2004 and in 2008 that were also approached to change their votes. As I said, you know, we had an elector in 2004 that voted for John Edwards twice. The question was whether or not they actually meant to vote for John Edwards. Maybe it was a mistake. In Minnesota at the time, the vote was actually a secret vote. No Minnesota elector has yet to say that they were the one that cast that faithless vote. It could have been simply a mistake. But yet, at the same time, John Edwards actually has a vote for President of the United States from 2004. If you take each electoral vote, you know, you're equating that to 700-some-thousand people. And so perhaps 700,000 people in Minnesota were actually disenfranchised by that one, you know, prospective mistake that somebody could have made.
Well, just in closing, Robert Alexander, given our discussion here today on the eve of this critical election, where I think we're adding, you know, not consciously, but we're adding to the kind of distrust. And as you know, on the right, there's this emphasis on voter fraud that's largely a myth. And on the left, there's a lot of paranoia about voting machines and who owns them, etc. What has to happen for us to just get over this broken system and have confidence again and make the elections about candidates and issues and not who can manipulate the vote?
Right. you know, any electoral process is going to have benefits and it's going to have problems. And so there's always going to be people that feel like they are benefited from the system. And there's going to be people that feel like they are cheated, certainly by the system. You know, one thing that proponents of certainly the Electoral College, they look at is they say that, you know, what will typically happen is that a president who wins the Electoral College is actually magnified. You know, Obama won, what, 50, 52%, something like that, 51%, 53%, I think, actually, in 2008. But he won like 67% of the electoral vote. So it makes it look much more of a landslide than it actually was. And so, you know, some people say that actually builds greater legitimacy into the process. Other people say that's just smoke and mirrors. And so I think with any process, even as you mentioned, if we went to a national popular vote, there'd be a lot of people probably in the middle of the country that would say, what about us? I think that's the great fear, is that the campaigns would actually just run to the coasts, go to where the people are, and never see people in some of the lesser populated states. So, I wish I had a magic elixir that everybody could drink and all would be well, but I don't think that that's something that, you know, it will be something that can really happen. I think that at the end of the day, if you have somebody that can show some true leadership in the country, I think that that's what's ultimately going to be able to bring people together. And I say somebody, and probably really, it won't be one person, but it will be, party leaders from both parties actually saying, wait a second, maybe everything doesn't have to be nuclear. Maybe we actually do have to engage in that you know, the dirty word of compromise. And we just haven't seen much of that in recent years.
Well, Robert Alexander, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent project is a book examining the Electoral College, which draws upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected with students over the past three elections. We're going to take a brief station break and come back and examine whether this race is the toss-up that the mainstream media claims it is.